December 26th, 1996, Chelmsley Wood, England. 13-year-old David Spencer and 11-year-old Patrick Warren claim that they are planning to spend the night at Patrick's brother's house, but they never arrive and are subsequently reported missing. The last confirmed sighting of them takes place at a petrol station, and Patrick's abandoned bicycle is found at the site next to some rubbish bins. Years later, Brian Field, a sex offender serving time in prison for the murder of another teenage boy, is looked at as a potential suspect in this case, but there is no conclusive evidence to implicate him, and the two boys are never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be traveling to the United Kingdom to profile one of the more famous unsolved missing children's cases, the 1996 disappearances of David Spencer and Patrick Warren. It's tradition for our podcast to spend the month of December covering holiday-themed mysteries, and this one just happened to take place on Boxing Day, a holiday which is celebrated after Christmas. Even though Boxing Day is not officially recognized as a holiday in the United States, it is celebrated in many other countries, including Canada, and it originated in Great Britain. And appropriately enough, one of the missing boys in today's episode was an aspiring boxer. David Spencer and Patrick Warren were best friends who happened to go missing together, and their case would become known as the Mystery of the Milk Carton Kids. While displaying the faces of missing children on milk cartons originated in North America during the 1980s, this particular case marked the first time it had ever been done in the United Kingdom. The story has always been shrouded in controversy, as is believed that since these two boys both hailed from working-class families, the police and the media did not take their disappearances as seriously as they should have. It was initially assumed that David and Patrick were runaways and would eventually resurface, even though a bicycle Patrick had just received as a Christmas gift was found abandoned at the location where they were last seen. While there has always been very little evidence to work with, the most promising suspect in this case is a sex offender named Brian Field, who is currently serving a life sentence for the murder of a teenage boy, which took place all the way back in 1968. Field has always denied any involvement in these disappearances, but since he is getting up there in age, there is fear from David and Patrick's families that if Field is guilty, investigators only have a limited amount of time to conclusively link him to this case and possibly recover the victim's remains. At the time of this recording, we are only weeks away from the 26th anniversary of these boys' disappearances, so I thought now would be an ideal time to do an episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I also just wanted to mention that next week, December the 21st, we'll be releasing one more episode about a holiday-themed mystery before I go on vacation for Christmas. However, our podcast is still going to be providing content during my absence, as on December the 28th, we'll be releasing a special Q&A episode, and our first episode of 2023, which comes out on January the 4th, is going to be another special update episode about cases from The Trail Went Cold which have either been solved or had major developments over the past year. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of David Spencer and Patrick Warren. Our story begins in 1996 in Chelmsley Wood, a working-class town located in the metropolitan borough of Solihull near Birmingham in West Midlands, England. Our victims are David Spencer, who has just recently turned 13, and 11-year-old Patrick Warren, who goes by the name Paddy and is only 9 days away from his 12th birthday. Even though they have only known each other for 3 months, they have developed a very close relationship and become best friends. David is currently being raised by his mother, Christine Hinken, and her longtime partner, Mickey O'Toole. David and his younger brother, Jonathan, are both from Christine's previous marriage, and Christine and Mickey have also had a son together named Lee. Paddy is one of 7 children in a large Irish family and is being raised by his divorced single mother, Bridget Warren. David and Paddy have both celebrated what were described as happy Christmases, and as a gift, Paddy received a red Apollo Laser bicycle, which he was quite thrilled with. On December the 26th, aka Boxing Day, Paddy had been planning to accompany his mother to his older sister's residence in Coventry, but he decided that he would prefer to spend the day hanging out with David. In fact, that afternoon, a police officer would come across David and Paddy playing with another group of children on a frozen lake in Meriden Park, and he warned them to stay off the ice and go home. That evening, the two boys paid a visit to David's residence and told his mother that they were planning to spend the night with Paddy's older brother, Andy Warren. They were both seen leaving at around 11:30 p.m. with David on foot and Paddy riding his brand new bicycle. However, the boys never arrived at Andy's residence, and when they failed to show up by morning, Andy went to David's home and discovered that the boys were not there either. Christine contacted the West Midlands police in order to officially report David and Paddy missing, but 3 days would pass before the police attempted to contact either the boys' families and follow up with them. Investigators were initially inclined to believe that David and Paddy had run away in order to have some sort of adventure and were hiding out and being given shelter by friends. Since both boys were known for having a rebellious side, the police figured that the boys were not in any immediate danger and would eventually resurface. Even though he was still only 11 years old, David had already started taking up boxing, as he was described as having an aggressive side. While Christine said that her son was a bright boy, she acknowledged that he was unpredictable and did not respond well to discipline. David had experienced a difficult year, as he had gotten in trouble with the police for theft and other misdemeanors, and spent time in and out of youth court. David wound up being excluded from mainstream schooling, and was placed under the supervision of a social worker, and there was a good chance he was going to be taken away from his family and placed in care if he did not turn things around. This was just one of the reasons that police were initially inclined to believe that David had decided to run away alongside Paddy, and even sent out a public plea, advising anyone who might be harboring the boys to come forward, and assured them there would be no repercussions. Of course, the boys' families were skeptical that they had taken off voluntarily, since they were not believed to be carrying any money, and did not seem to have anything in their possession besides the clothes on their backs. It would turn out that the last confirmed sighting of David and Paddy took place at around 12:45 a.m. on December the 27th, as Ellen Morgan, a petrol station attendant who knew the boys personally, reported that they stopped by the station and she gave them a packet of biscuits. Morgan did not report seeing or hearing anything unusual, and said the two boys appeared to be walking towards a local shopping center when they left. Well, later that same day, Paddy's abandoned bicycle was discovered behind the petrol station next to some rubbish bins, but it would be several weeks before police even realized that the bike belonged to him. This caused major alarm bells to go off for the boys' families, as they did not believe Paddy would have abandoned his prized Christmas gift if he was planning to run away. When the boys failed to resurface after being gone for 3 months, the West Midlands Police's Criminal Investigation Division finally became involved and started exploring the possibility that David and Paddy had become the victims of foul play. Since they had both been playing on a frozen lake on the day of their disappearances, police performed a search of the water to see if they might have fallen in there accidentally, but nothing was found. In April of 1997, the case wound up making British history when the National Missing Persons Helpline launched a new campaign where the faces of missing children would be featured on milk cartons being sold at the Iceland supermarket chain all over England in order to generate additional exposure for their cases. Since David and Paddy were the first British missing children to be featured like this, they became known as the Milk Carton Kids. Over the next several years, there would be a number of reported sightings of the boys in order to lend credence to the theory that they had run away and were still alive somewhere, but none of these sightings ever panned out. In May of 1999, Christine Hinken finally got married to her longtime partner, Mickey O'Toole, and publicly expressed hope that this might compel David to return home, or at the very least, contact her to confirm he was okay. Christine would say that she once suffered a nervous breakdown over the situation, as she never went on holiday and rarely left her home, for fear that her son would show up or attempt to call her while she was gone. Bridget Warren reached the point where the depression of her son's disappearance was so severe that she could no longer openly talk about the case, and the Warren family have completely shied away from the spotlight in recent years. In August of 2003, the West Midlands police announced that they had arrested a 37-year-old Birmingham man in connection with the disappearances. 18 months earlier, the police had received an anonymous letter stating that the missing boys' bodies had been buried in Woodgate Valley Country Park. This letter was traced to Birmingham Prison, though it's unclear if investigators were able to figure out the identity of the writer. The name of the man who was arrested was never released publicly, and it was only revealed that he had recently completed a jail sentence. I have no idea what led to his arrest, but he was released on bail and no charges were ever filed against him, so it sounds like this lead ultimately went nowhere. However, in 2006, a more promising lead would emerge when police announced that a 70-year-old convicted murderer and pedophile named Brian Field had become the prime suspect in David and Patty's disappearances. Throughout the course of his life, Field had been in and out of prison after receiving no less than 6 convictions for sexual offenses against young boys. In August of 1999, Field was living in Solihull and working as a farm laborer and landscape gardener when he was arrested for drunk driving and given a routine swab to obtain a sample of his DNA. Well, a year and a half later, Field's DNA wound up being linked to one of England's most famous unsolved cold cases. On the afternoon of April the 23rd, 1968, 14-year-old Roy Tootle turned up missing after leaving Kingston Grammar School in Surrey. Roy initially boarded a bus with friends, but since he was hoping to save up money to buy a new bicycle and train set, he decided that he would avoid paying the bus fare and hitchhike the rest of the way home. Well, Roy never arrived, and 3 days later, his body was discovered on an estate in the village of Mickleham. His clothing was folded across his body, and it turned out that he had been sexually assaulted before he was strangled to death. The case remained unsolved for 3 decades, until DNA testing was performed on a semen stain from Roy's trousers, and it wound up being a match to Brian Field. Field was taken into custody on February the 21st, 2001, and even though he initially denied any involvement in the crime, he was asked to submit additional DNA samples before he was placed inside a holding cell. The following morning, Field said that his anxiety over the situation prevented him from getting any sleep, so he finally broke down and made a full confession to Roy's murder. Field said that he had picked up Roy hitchhiking and proceeded to rape and fatally strangle the boy inside his car. He then placed Roy's body inside the trunk and, remarkably, went home to his family and kept the body in the car for 3 days before he dumped it in Mickleham. 8 months after his confession, Field pled guilty to Roy's murder and received a sentence of life imprisonment. At the time, the nearly 33-year gap between the murder and Field's arrest made this the oldest cold case to ever be solved in the United Kingdom. Well, years after his conviction, Field was interviewed about the disappearances of David Spencer and Patrick Warren, and while he denied any involvement, investigators considered him to be a promising suspect. In 1996, Field had been living in Solihull, only about a few miles away from the petrol station where David and Patty were last seen, and he was also known for being a regular drinker at a pub located near the boys' residence in Chelmsley Wood. In fact, on the night they went missing, there were reports that Field had been seen driving around the area in a white van while under the influence of alcohol, which was an important detail since Field was known for getting violent and committing many of his crimes while he was intoxicated. Since Field was a self-employed gardener at the time, he also had knowledge of and access to open land, which would have been ideal locations to dispose of victims' bodies. Shortly after Field was interrogated, the West Midlands police performed a dig of Dampson Park, which was located only about a half mile away from where Field had been living in 1996, but nothing was found. Even though there was no direct evidence against Field, One of his previous offenses occurred in June of 1986, when he attempted to abduct two teenage boys near the town of Oswestry, who were ages 13 and 16. Field lured the two boys into his car by offering them a ride, but as he was driving with both of them in the back seat, they realized that he was going in a different direction than they had asked him to go. While he was still behind the wheel, Field threatened the boys with a wheel brace and told them to take off their clothes, but they managed to escape by jumping out of the moving car. After they went to the police, it wasn't long before Field was tracked down and arrested, and he wound up receiving a 4-year prison sentence. This marked the only time in the history of the United Kingdom in which a defendant was convicted of the simultaneous abduction of two teenage boys, so investigators believe that Field might have been capable of doing the same thing to David and Patty. In June of 2021, a new TV miniseries was released titled In the Footsteps of Killers, which featured criminologist David Wilson and actress Amelia Fox, who stars in the BBC crime drama Silent Witness, exploring unsolved cold cases. One of their episodes covered the milk carton kids mystery, and during their investigation, they wound up uncovering a document written by one of the former investigators on the case, who said that he was looking for a quote-unquote reluctant witness who had seen David and Patty with Brian Field a few days before they disappeared. This eyewitness account has never been corroborated, but if it was accurate, it might suggest that Field had been grooming the two boys before he abducted them. The episode also featured an interview with Graham Hill, the former detective who got Field to confess to the murder of Roy Tootle. Hill stated, quote, "I don't believe in coincidences. You've got a man who's got a previous conviction for abducting two children together. He's in the vicinity of where two boys go missing. Ultimately, for me, that makes him a very good suspect for the boys. In my view, I've never seen a better suspect for the abduction of those boys than Brian Field." End quote. Following the release of the episode, an eyewitness came forward who frequently drank with Field back in 1996 and claimed that in the days following David and Patty's disappearances, he saw Field digging and filling in holes near the Solihull Moors in the village of Elmden. The police ultimately decided not to perform a dig there and put out a statement in which they expressed their belief that the information provided by the witness was, quote-unquote, not consistent with the known chronology of events. However, David's half-brother, Leo Toole, decided to organize his own dig at the location, which would be performed by volunteers, and he told the media, quote, "We're here because the police don't want to be here. We've asked the police to attend, we've asked them to do it properly, and they're not interested." End quote. The dig did not turn up any evidence, but 1 year later, in June of 2022, Lee helped organize another dig involving volunteers, which was based on information that was provided to him by a source. It took place at another undisclosed site near Chelmsley Wood, but once again, nothing was found. At the time of this recording, Brian Field is still incarcerated and currently 86 years old, but nothing has conclusively linked him to the milk carton kids case, so David Spencer and Patrick Warren continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So it goes without saying that all missing children's cases are tragic and heartbreaking, but stories in which multiple people happen to go missing at the same time are particularly shocking. On the surface, it seems difficult for one predator to be able to subdue and handle multiple victims, which might just be one of the reasons why the disappearances of these two boys were not treated with immediate urgency by the authorities. Since David Spencer and Patrick Warren attained notoriety by having their faces featured on milk cartons only 4 months after they went missing and became known as the Milk Carton Kids, you would probably be under the impression that their story received a lot of exposure in the media. However, while they weren't completely ignored per se, the press coverage was a bit different than your standard missing children's case. Here's a quote from David Wilson which perfectly sums up this whole situation. Quote, "There was a sense that they weren't really children when in fact they were. If it had been two boys from middle-class Solihull that went missing, that case would have been treated initially very differently. And it's about that word we're never allowed to use, class. This was about a class judgment that was made which was prepared to see them as runaways as opposed to vulnerable." End quote. Indeed, It's kind of jarring to go back into the newspaper archives and read articles which were written in the weeks following David and Patty's disappearances, as there's a surprising lack of urgency with how the story is being reported and how the police are handling the investigation. It seems like the original attitude was that the boys had simply run away and were hiding out somewhere and would resurface eventually. One investigator from the West Midlands Police even stated that there was no reason to believe that David and Patty had come to any harm, even though they were only 13 and 11 years old respectively and on their own in the middle of winter without any money or personal possessions. While no one would really describe David and Patty as bad kids per se, they were definitely not innocent little angels, as David in particular had been experiencing a lot of discipline problems during the past year. In fact, some of the sources described one of the boys as being a chain smoker, though they never specified which one. But one phrase which was constantly used to describe the boys during the original media coverage of this case was streetwise, as if to indicate that in spite of their young ages, David and Patty could take care of themselves, and there was no reason to believe they were in any danger. Comparisons have often been made between this case and the disappearance of 17-year-old Nicola Dixon, who went missing after leaving her home in the nearby town of Sutton Coldfield on New Year's Eve, 5 days after David and Patty vanished. The following day, Nicola's body was discovered in a graveyard, as she had been sexually assaulted before her attacker smashed her head against a curb, causing her to succumb to massive head injuries. Needless to say, the two boys' disappearances were pretty much pushed out of the headlines by Nicola's murder, as she fit the media stereotype of a quote-unquote ideal victim, since she was female, hailed from a middle-class family, and had no history of trouble in her background. 6 years later, there would be a resolution in this case, when DNA testing finally linked Nicola's murder to a suspect named Colin Waite, but since David and Patty are still missing to this day, they have not received the same justice. And as an aside, the milk carton kids mystery is not even the most famous unsolved case involving a child victim to take place on December the 26th, 1996, because as you're probably aware, that's the same date when JonBenet Ramsey was found murdered inside her home. Given their rebellious backgrounds, it certainly wasn't unreasonable to initially assume that David and Patty might have run away, but as far as I'm concerned, this theory should have been completely discounted once they found Patty's abandoned bicycle near the petrol station where the two boys were last seen. Patty had just received that bike as a Christmas present and had been using it non-stop ever since, so if the two boys wanted to take off somewhere, it made no sense for him to leave the bike unattended in a public place. This suggests that something happened to the boys shortly after they interacted with the attendant at the petrol station, or they crossed paths with someone at another location who decided to return the bike to the station in order to throw off the investigation. But frustratingly, even though the bicycle was found on the day after they disappeared, police did not put two and two together for several weeks, even though this should have been an immediate red flag. Unfortunately, that bike is pretty much the only clue in this case, and I don't get the impression it was properly preserved as evidence, so I have no idea if the perpetrator may have left their fingerprints or DNA on there. In the months following the boys' disappearance, there would be numerous sightings of David and Patty, and some of them were from witnesses who specifically reported seeing two boys together. However, I'm inclined to believe that all these sightings were mistaken, as sadly, I do not believe that David and Patty lived much longer after they were seen by the attendant at the petrol station. The attendant, Ellen Morgan, was tracked down and interviewed for the In the Footsteps of Killers episode, and to this day, she maintains that she did not see or hear anything unusual that night. So this makes me wonder if the boys were not forcibly abducted, but rather climbed into a vehicle on their own accord. It seems one of the reasons their disappearance was not noticed until morning is because each of their families assumed they were staying at the other boy's residence. We know that they told David's mother that they were planning to spend the night with Patrick's brother, Andy, but I get the impression that Andy was not immediately concerned when they didn't show up and just assumed they were staying at David's place. It's definitely unusual that two boys their age would be hanging out at a petrol station by themselves at 12:45 a.m., so there has been speculation that they could have been planning to meet someone there. According to the original police reports, there was one witness who thought they saw David and Patty with Brian Field in the days prior to their disappearances, so perhaps he was grooming them. We'll talk about Field momentarily, since he is the most likely suspect, but I guess I should make a brief mention of the unnamed individual who was briefly arrested and detained in relation to this case in 2003 before he was released on bail. Unfortunately, we don't have any details about who this person was or why police felt compelled to arrest him, only that it came about after they received an anonymous letter about the missing boys, which was sent from Birmingham Prison. The name of this individual was never released publicly, but investigators did say he had recently completed a jail sentence, so we know that it was not Brian Field, because he was already serving a sentence for Roy Tootle's murder by that point. And this person was described as being 37 years old, whereas Field would have been in his late 60s. However, now that Field has become the primary focus of the investigation, it's possible that police no longer believe that the 37-year-old has any relevance to this case. So now let's start discussing Brian Field, and you really can't describe him as anything more than an absolute monster who definitely seems like he would have been capable of murdering David and Patty. I watched a documentary about Field which once aired on British television and chronicled how he was charged for Roy Tootle's murder, and he's one of the more frightening child murderers slash pedophiles I've ever seen. He was described as having a Jekyll and Hyde personality, as he apparently had an outwardly charming and engaging personality, and a mask of normalcy that covered his dark and devious nature. Field was abandoned by his mother immediately after he was born, and placed in a foster home alongside 12 other boys. It seems like Field was raised in a loving, stable environment, as his adoptive father was a social worker and was once honored by the Queen for his work with children. In 1957, Field and his family made an appearance on an episode of the British version of the TV series This Is Your Life, while he was dressed in his Royal Marines uniform, and his life was presented as a heartwarming rags-to-riches story about an unwanted child who was placed with the right family and went on to achieve success. But nobody knew that Field had a much darker side, because when he was only 15 years old, Field strangled and sexually assaulted an 11-year-old girl, and while she survived the attack, it does not sound like Field ever faced any legal consequences for his actions. Field wound up getting married, but lost his first wife in a traffic accident in 1966, though he wound up getting remarried and had his first child only 1 year later. Field also got a job as a public relations representative with the Milk Marketing Board, and there's even existing footage of a television interview he did for them in February of 1968. That footage is pretty chilling to watch, because Field really does come across as a likable guy, and not the type of person you would envision to rape and murder a 14-year-old just 2 months later. And what's even more shocking about Roy Tootle's murder is that it took place only 11 days after the birth of Field's second child. When Field was convicted of the crime 3 decades later, the younger brother of Field's second wife came forward and revealed that shortly after they got married, Field started sexually abusing him for years and threatened to kill him if he ever told anyone about it. The brother also recalled that on the day Roy was murdered, Field came home and yelled at him to stay away from the garage. In retrospect, it seems likely that Roy's body was still inside the trunk of Field's car at the time, since he did not dump it until 3 days later. It's also worth mentioning that Field has been looked at as a potential suspect in another cold case involving a teenage boy. This one took place in the community of South Yardley, and the victim in question was 15-year-old Mark Billington, who went missing after leaving his home on his bicycle to fly a kite on September 1, 1984. And much like Patty Warren, Mark's abandoned bike was found in the area. Just over 2 months later, Mark's decomposed body was discovered hanging from a tree in a wooded area located 7 miles from his home. The police initially believed that Mark's death was a suicide, but his family would not accept that at all. Since Mark was developmentally delayed and had a mental disability, it did not even seem like he was capable of tying the complicated knot found on the tow rope used to hang him, and no one could figure out how he would have attained such a rope to begin with. After an inquest, the coroner originally returned an open verdict, but the West Midlands police agreed to perform a new review of the case several years later, and found there to be enough suspicious discrepancies that Mark's death was officially reclassified as a homicide in 2002. Unfortunately, since the original investigators treated the whole thing as a suicide, they wound up losing many key pieces of evidence, such as the rope and Mark's clothing, negating any potential opportunity to extract DNA that might belong to the killer. Well, it turned out that in the weeks prior to Mark's disappearance, Ryan Field was released from prison, where he'd been serving a sentence for gross indecency after fondling a 17-year-old boy, and he was living only a mile and a half away from the Billington family's residence. In recent years, the Billingtons have begged the police to visit Field in prison and interview him about Mark's case, but this has never taken place. I'm not sure if investigators are convinced that Field is the guilty party in this case, as they previously made mention of looking at a group of teenagers who had been seen in a park behind Mark's house as he was flying his kite. It's also been reported that Mark later went to a building society in order to deposit money he had earned from his paper route, and these same teenagers were seen there. However, no further details have been released about who these teenagers are and what possible motive they might have had for killing Mark and hanging him from a tree. And since Mark's body was heavily decomposed when he was found, and his death was not treated like a homicide investigation, I'm not sure if they were able to determine if he was sexually assaulted, which would definitely point to an offender like Field being responsible. Without any further information, I really can't say for certain if Field was the perpetrator, but he's definitely a promising suspect, as no one would be surprised if Roy Tootle wasn't his only murder victim. So by 1996, Field had already served multiple stints in prison for sexual offenses against boys, so he had been divorced by his wife and disowned by his children and was pretty much living as a loner in the Solihull area. After he was imprisoned for his failed abduction attempt of the two teenage boys, he was released in 1990, and given that he was an habitual sex offender, a lot of people find it unlikely that Field would have been able to go an entire decade without harming anyone else before he was charged with Roy Tootle's murder in 2001. One of the main reasons Field is considered to be a compelling suspect in the Milk Carton Kids case is because he had previously attempted to abduct two teenage boys at the same time, and if they hadn't managed to escape, there's a good chance he would have killed them. Now, since Field is going to remain in prison for the rest of his life and has nothing left to lose, you might be wondering why he wouldn't just confess to the murders of David, Patty, or Mark if he was the responsible party. But the issue with Field and other convicted murderers just like him is that they are narcissistic sociopaths who sometimes get off on toying with people and deliberately withholding information about other murders they committed. Even if they did not get away with the crime that put them in prison, they may still take pleasure in the fact that they managed to get away with other crimes. One odd thing about Field is that even though he was willing to confess and plead guilty to Roy's murder, he refused to plead guilty to the charge of sexually assaulting Roy, as he said that admitting to being a pedophile would make his life more difficult in prison. Well, that's some pretty faulty logic, since he had already served time in prison for sex offenses against other boys, and I think being an admitted child murderer would make his life difficult enough. But this just goes to show that in his own twisted mind, Field may have had his own reasons for not wanting to admit culpability in any other crimes. Obviously, the most baffling element of the Milk Carton Kids mystery is that we have two boys who just seem to vanish into thin air without leaving any evidence behind, and no one reported seeing or hearing anything unusual. David and Patty were both portrayed as being tough, streetwise kids who knew how to take care of themselves, so it would have been difficult for one individual to abduct both of them simultaneously. And since David was an aspiring boxer who had already fought some bouts in the ring, I'm sure he would have put up a fight. But one of the main reasons that Field seems like such a compelling suspect is because he is technically the only individual in the history of the United Kingdom to be charged and convicted of abducting two teenage boys at the same time, so he's definitely brazen enough to try something like that. Now, on one hand, the abduction attempt from 1986 was unsuccessful and led to Field going to prison, so this could have scared him off from attempting something like that again. But on the other hand, maybe the lack of success only made him extra motivated to try and abduct two boys when the opportunity presented itself. I know that Field would have been 60 years old by this point, but because he made his living doing manual labor, he was still in excellent physical shape. We have uncorroborated reports that Field was seen driving a white van that night while intoxicated, and it sounds like alcohol practically turned him into a different person and gave him the extra push he needed to commit his crimes. So if Field somehow managed to lure David and Patty into his van, this would have been an ideal place to hold him captive before he killed them. I have to hearken back to this unconfirmed eyewitness sighting of Field with the two boys in the days prior to their disappearances, because if they did have prior contact with them, then this could mean that Field arranged to meet them somewhere on the night they went missing, and might provide an explanation for how he managed to abduct them without causing a scene. Since he worked as a landscape gardener and had lots of experience digging, Field would have known of ideal locations to dispose of the boys' bodies and ensure they were never found, and we have this recent tip from a former acquaintance of Field's who said he saw him digging and filling in holes near the Solihull Moors. For whatever reason, the West Midlands police do not think this tip is credible enough to perform their own dig at this location, which is why David's half-brother Lee has taken the initiative to organize his own digs. I can understand Lee's frustration, as the two boys' families have always been very critical of the West Midlands police for mishandling the investigation. But if these digs manage to turn up any remains or some sort of important evidence, I can also see some potential legal issues arising over this evidence being unearthed and handled by civilians who are not affiliated with law enforcement. However, these legal issues may be of little concern to David and Patty's families, because all they want to do is bring the boys home and give them a proper burial. If Brian Field was responsible for murdering them, then prosecuting him is not a priority since he is 86 years old and already serving a life sentence. I'm sure they can take comfort in knowing that Field will never get out of prison, but at the same time, the clock is ticking and there's only a limited amount of time left to get him to talk. I hate to think that when Field passes away, he'll be able to take the secret of what happened to these two boys with him. The fact that Field was conclusively linked to Roy Tootle's murder after 3 decades shows that no cold case is truly unsolvable, but of course, the key difference here is that we still don't have the victims' bodies or any physical evidence. So at this point, it might require the right person coming forward with information in order to break this case wide open. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearances of David Spencer and Patrick Warren, aka the Milk Carton Kids, please contact the West Midlands Police. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the murder of Eileen Mangold, a case featured on Unsolved Mysteries which really should have been solved, but wasn't. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1990 death of Chad Maurer. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Stephanie D., Don R., Peyton B., Trish D., Laura, Mandy C.B., Todd W., and Cheryl K. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, since we covered a case from the United Kingdom this week, I wanted to mention again that I have officially signed to make my return to CrimeCon UK next year, as the world's number one true crime event is returning to London on June the 10th and 11th of 2023. It's the ultimate true crime weekend partnered by CBS Reality, the expert-led true crime channel. It's your opportunity to get inside the minds of serial killers and psychopaths, learn from leading criminologists, hear from families and survivors, and immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. And of course, it's also a great opportunity to meet your favorite true crime podcasters and creators, including The Trail Went Cold, in the events content creators area. Tickets are on sale now, so in order to join us and get a special 10% discount, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the special promo code COLD23. That's crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COLD23. Hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for our final holiday-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.